Cameron.
We were hoping that Steve would keep his comments brief.
We've got events to talk about coming up in a few years, too, that we'll take an intermission and Steve will... welcome, and what a gorgeous night, and what a lovely place this is. This is our first time, so it's really great, so thanks for having us out here. Before we jump right in, which is what we absolutely want to do, I want to talk about the people who are to Rick's right, physically, not necessarily politically speaking. We've got Joe DeSano to Rick's right here. He is a Democratic strategist, brilliant political mind, co-founder of Main Street Strategies, and maybe more importantly, married to Susan Demas, who I was so bummed is not here tonight. You read Susan's columns in M Live.
Publisher of Inside Michigan Politics.
Indeed.
Small business person.
So not that we're not really happy to have Joe here, too. Sorry. Joe. In 2011, Joe was named one of Michigan's most influential Democrats by the very well-respected journal Campaigns and Elections. He has worked in the Michigan State House as well as for a period of time with then-Congressman John Dingell. Joe DeSano, thank you for being here this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, and to Joe's right, I think we can say that literally, Republican Ken Sikkema. He is the former majority leader of the state Senate, so kind of a big deal, guys. He was in the state legislature for nearly 20 years, from 1987 to 2006. He is now a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. And you, because this is just so Lansing, can actually hear him on Michigan radio Thursday afternoons with Joe's wife, Susan Demas. They do a political segment once a week on Thursdays.
I think
all
we need to widen our circle.
Host, Jen White. So that's where you hear Ken. So welcome to Ken Sikkema as well this evening. Yeah.
Well, thank you, and welcome to Grand Rapids in West Michigan.
Thank you for having us. This is indeed your region. So, Rick, what do you?
I graduated from high school from West Ottawa, just a little west of here.
Yeah. Although Rick's always a little worried at these things to say it because he's worried there's going to be like old teachers who find him afterwards, and it's happened. It's awesome. So
if I owe you money, I'm sorry.
Rick, is there like a political stories or something happening that you think maybe makes the most sense that people
are
talking about?
The day after the Proposal 1 election, and someone very smart once described the job of the political journalist or pundit. Pundits as the people who come down from the mountains after the battle to bayonet the wounded.
Yeah. Or the folks who absolutely knew what was going to happen.
So here we are.
You know, and now that it's happened. Let's do a show of hands. Let's see. How many of you, I mean, and if you don't want to at least raise your hand and say if you voted, you don't have to do that either. But how many folks did go out to the polls if you'd like to share that information? Wow. Okay, so there was a...
I see like a grimace back there. Like.
I did it. And if you're so inclined, again, you don't have to. How many folks, if you want to say, voted yes for that proposal? Wow, okay. Well, that is not the percentage...
Amazingly, you're in the minority.
This could be everyone.
This could be everyone.
You guys were the 20%. If you haven't heard yet... Prop 1 went down in flames. I think you could come up with a whole cliche list that us journalists have been using. You know,
wreckage, roadkill.
Oh, that's just bad. But if you haven't heard all of the results yet, we were talking earlier. There were a lot of guesses that it was going to go down most likely 60-40. Some folks maybe 70-30. We saw a whooping 80%. No vote. And also interesting to note, in a May election where there's usually a very small turnout.
Who says
turnout,
we can't agree on anything?
25% turnout, which sounds awful. And it is, because that's minuscule and sad, but it's a way higher than most folks were predicting. I think just one more indication of how hated this ballot was. So enough of us talking about it. Joe, let's go to you first.
What happened?
What went wrong?
Well, first of all, I've been pondering for the past 20 hours or so what would have gotten a bigger no vote? Slavery, maybe? Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, how unpopular can something be?
Well, I guess, quickly, game it out for us. Where did things go wrong and when? And I suspect, I'm taking a guess here, that you will start with the last day of the lame duck session last year.
Well, I think you have the whole sausage making of how this got on the ballot. I mean, clearly that was not a, a high point in the legislative process, and I'll defer to the former majority leader to give us his insight on just how ugly those horse trading and sausage making can be. But I mean, I think really the turning point was when the governor's office blew up the campaign team.
Yeah.
I mean,
there was very early in the campaign, and they switched out the communications people, the managers.
Oh, absolutely. That was that gave. There was very little chance of this passing in, under any set of circumstances. Let's be honest. That was a disastrous start, and I don't think it ever recovered.
For Kent Sikkema, in your experience, you know, a lot of people weren't just caught up in what was in Proposal 1, all the many varied elements of it, but also how it got to be there and what it was. In your experience, does process usually play such a big part in a ballot question?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question, so I think I'll answer a different question.
Can you tell he's a politician?
You can tell how he got to where he is today.
So I hasn't quite gotten over that.
I think it is, you're almost going to guarantee a defeat at the ballot box when you tell the voters it's about one thing, but they find out through various sources that really isn't true, that it's about a lot of things. So in this case, we go to the voters, the legislature and the governor, and say, here's a ballot proposal to fix the roads. Now, I think generally speaking, most people in Michigan believe we need to do something to fix the roads. But you tell the voters we're going to give you a ballot proposal to raise taxes to fix the roads, but through the process of the campaign, they find out that there's a lot of other things in it, too, that aren't related to fixing the roads. There is, for example, there's an increase in funding for public schools. Okay, well, we can have a discussion about that, but that's not about fixing the roads.
Let me just say one more thing.
Zoe. There was a change in the tax code to help low-income working people. Okay, maybe that's good, but it's not about fixing the roads. Now, you know, that you already have government at a low level of public trust, and when they find out that they're basically being had, you're guaranteeing that, you know.
This would have solved the roads problem, though.
It would have, but what I want to get to, isn't this systematic, isn't this what is at the heart right now of Lansing, though, is that they couldn't get this ballot. There was no possibility that roads were going to get fixed, and they had to add those additional things in order to get enough support in the legislature to get it on the ballot.
Well, but let's talk about who they needed to get support from and who failed to put together the legislation in the first place. I mean, look, you have Republicans controlling the governor's office. You have Republicans controlling the Senate. You have Republicans controlling the House. And in essence, if we're making sausage, they own the cow, they own the factory, and they own the store. It's up to them.
Is this a pure Republican problem then?
I'm going to try to simplify this. The last time, and let me give you, I guess, looking at the panel, I'm the senior citizen here.
Actually, you came to Lansing the same year I did.
Okay. The last time we had what I would call a road-fixing crisis was in the mid-1990s. Roads were falling apart, all kinds of potholes. That we obviously had to fix the roads, and in 1997, we raised the gas tax to fix the roads. This is not rocket science. The gas tax is a user fee. All the money goes in for transportation. We raised the gas tax in 1997, and let me just say this. Half of the Republicans in the House voted for that gas tax increase. Every Republican except one in the Senate voted for that gas tax increase, and a Republican governor signed it. Now, what's happened? What has happened between 1997 and 2015 that seems to paralyze the Republican Party when you use the word tax? The political climate inside the Republican Party has dramatically shifted, where it has become excruciatingly difficult to raise revenue, yes, it's a tax or it's a fee, with all Republican votes. And this is sort of...
It's no tax pledges.
And well, and because you have the Tea Party phenomenon that occurred in 2010, and so the Republican Party has just changed so dramatically, and with social media and cell phones and the internet and the ability to organize people that way and strike fear in the hearts of, you know, sitting office holders has just changed the political climate. Now, this particular issue, you go back to December, you know, in order to raise the sales tax, which this does, this proposal would have done, excuse me, you have to go to the ballot because of our Constitution. The legislature can't raise a sales tax. Okay, now you need two-thirds vote to put it on the ballot, and with a bunch of Republicans not going to do that, you have to go to the Democrats to get support, and they insisted on the earned income tax credit, more money for schools, more money for local government, and some other things. I don't blame them for it. With the Republican majorities, the super majorities, it's really their only chance to, you know, use leverage to get some stuff. But then again, you go to the voters with a complicated proposal, and it's guaranteed to fall apart.
Yeah, one of the organizers of the Vote Yes campaign this morning called complexity the kryptonite of yes votes.
But let me
comes
and
to
I would just say
campaigns.
This, and I agree with Joe that Republicans are in charge in Lansing, House, Senate, Governor. They have to solve this problem. This is a defining issue for Republicans in Lansing this session. I don't believe in legacies among for politicians, but this is their defining issue. Their legacy is going to be whether or not they fix the roads, regardless of the other stuff they do.
So let's open it up to some questions, because we could go on, and we will if I don't remind myself that we want to answer your questions. That's actually way more
interesting.
Well,
you're waiting for that. So. I'm going to pose one, though, that I think one of the things that we're going to see, and this is a can of worms that comes up every, I don't know, decade or so, and I think it came up while you were in the legislature that...
I think it happened in the 1940s, too, when you were in Lansing as well. So.
Oh, when we both arrived. That there was this big effort to go and wall off a lot of dedicated funds that were used for things like veterans benefits, buying up land for parks and recreation, and all of that. And now, as we start looking for road funding, and that revenue, that new revenue has to be either not a part of it or a much less significant part of it, is our Lansing lawmakers are going to start looking toward those funds. Some people in the Vote No campaign were saying that was kind of an easy fix. How hard a time are they going to have if they go looking toward the Natural Resources Trust Fund, for example, as a place to tap for road money?
You know, the stages of grief. Are you familiar with the five stages of grief? You start with denial. You go to anger, you then go to bargaining, you then go to depression, and then you go to acceptance. The five stages of grief. The first stage, in terms of denial on this issue, is Republicans denying the fact you have to raise more money for roads. That is denial. It is a fiction, a myth.
This has been a pretty lengthy stage, then.
That you can find $1.2 billion every year in the current state budget to fix the roads. It's a myth. And it's in the stages of grief. It's called denial.
Well, I just want to get to the sixth stage of having a nice smooth ride in the hearse to the dropped into the ground. That shouldn't be too much to ask in a state like Michigan.
So we can continue to talk road funding. We will. That is going to be the topic du jour this evening. But I also want to make sure we get questions. So, Anna, it looks like you've got someone over there. And if you'll say your name, just your first name and where you're from, that's helpful just so we know who you are.
Whether or not you went to West Ottawa High School.
I'm Charlie, and I'm from Grand Rapids.
Hi, Charlie.
And so if there is consensus that the roads need to be repaired, improved on a continuing basis, if the legislature won't deal with it, does this come back to the voters? Or does the legislature get the message that this is their job?
So Charlie's question, if you couldn't hear, was, is this something now that is going to stay with the legislature? Or once again, might we see, and this has been sort of, again, the word du jour, might it be punted back to the voters? Joe, from a strategy point of view, could you possibly see lawmakers deciding yet again to put something like this on the ballot?
I suppose.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think it would be successful at this point. I think there is kind of a hangover here on this subject. I think one of the reasons this thing failed yesterday was I think a decidedly large number of the public thought, hey, this is what we send you clowns to Lansing to fix. I mean, we live in a, you know,
we heard that a lot. Yeah.
You know, yeah. We're deferring to the specialists to fix the problem.
So if we did see it go back to the voters in terms of a ballot, it sounds to me, Ken, like what you were saying earlier, is it would have to be one simple revenue enhancement, right? Nothing else. It would be just money that is just going for the roads.
Well, actually, I think it could go back to the ballot. And let me just, once again, a little historical perspective. If you go back a generation, the biggest issue facing the state and the legislature, the public, the governor, was school funding reform. And in 1980, a proposal was put on the ballot. There already had been a number of proposals on the ballot prior to that to fix school funding. A proposal was put on the ballot that was defeated 21-79, almost the same percentage. Yeah. And then after that, there were other proposals that were put on the ballot to change school funding. Ultimately, it culminated in Proposal A of 1994, which actually did go to the ballot. But what the
in something of a political accident.
Well, but what the legislature and the governor did, though, they didn't just put something on the ballot for up or down vote.
Yeah.
And if the voters rejected it, they had to go back to the drawing board. They basically passed a proposal to change school funding and then said to the voters, here's another option.
Yeah.
You can do this option if you want, but we're going to change school funding, and we're either going to use the sales tax or the income tax. You can pick.
Yeah, Governor Snyder, for one, expressed some regret that he thought that this would have turned out differently, perhaps, if it were an either-or proposition as opposed to an up or down one. And this is even something that was discussed like, from the moment it was passed.
Let me give you an example of what they could do. They could raise the gas tax, which they can do,
without a ballot proposal.
To put a billion two into roads, raise a gas tax like we did in 1997. And then they could put on the ballot, if you want to raise the sales tax to do it instead, hey, have at it.
But what's the difference between now and then? It's about leadership. It's about adults in power. I mean, already we've seen Speaker Cotter say that it's going to be a revenue neutral solution. You know, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? They're going to come. They're going to go hit this DNR fund. They're going to gut education, or at least propose to. I mean, there's just the majority leader here is absolutely correct. And you got a Republican Party that owns Lansing, and this is their problem. And I just don't see any leadership there. I mean, I think the governor bears a lot of responsibility for what happened yesterday. I really do. I don't agree with much of what John Engler did during his 12 years, but that man was a strong leader, and he exhibited leadership traits that this governor just doesn't have.
Well, you know, we've heard a lot of discussion throughout the course of the campaign and now again about, you know, a plan B. And, you know, as we have pointed out, and you guys have probably pointed out too, that you know, there was never a plan B. There was a multitude of plan Bs. As a matter of fact, by the time we got to Proposal 1 was like plan
M.
You know, M, yeah. L, M, yeah. N, O, yeah. P, Q, R, yeah. You know. get higher up into the alphabet, and then we've got to move into other alphabets. And we're doing the same thing here, is that lots of proposals were thrown down, that they all failed to get any traction. And the only reason, I mean, this proposal one, was, disagree with me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. Proposal one was a Hail Mary pass, that they couldn't get to anything else. And so they threw this out there to see if it just might happen. And, you know, they lost.
It was a Hail Mary pass that I think a bunch of teammates decided on. And then 2 weeks later, half of those teammates were gone. And what I'm alluding to is a lot of the lawmakers that decided, along with Governor Snyder, let's try this, were term limited. I'd love to also talk about term limits. I think that's a huge issue. Ken, I want to hear your thoughts on term limits and what that has meant for Lansing, but I also want to get to more questions. Yeah, Anna.
Hello. Can you hear me over there?
Oh, yes.
Oh, cool. Gerald from Grand Rapids.
Hi, Gerald.
And the question I've got to ask, as far as both parties, do they actually care enough to fix the problem, or are they going to be more concerned about getting political points with their base? How many Republicans are more concerned about the roads than keeping their no new taxes under any circumstances base happy?
Yeah. Well,
how many Democrats are more enough concerned about the roads to say, we will do this without anything else? Roads, only roads, nothing but roads, and everything else gets saved for another day.
Well, let's get some answers. And Ken, having been in the legislature, I mean, how much, when you're dealing with a controversial issue like this, do you weigh the public interest and do you weigh, hey, you know, I did sign this no new taxes pledge. Hey, I've got to go back to my constituents and say, I just raised your taxes in some capacity.
Well, it clearly, obviously, is a major factor in Lansing or Washington, frankly, deliberations. I can't deny that. I think I've sort of already said that if you compare what happened here with 1997, when the vast majority of Republicans at the Capitol voted for a gas tax increase to fix the roads, it clearly is a difference. There's a new dynamic inside the Republican Party that is fueled in part by changes in technology. So I think it's a huge, you put your finger on it, it's there. I would be critical of the Democrats, as you sort of were, by, you know, if you insist that we're going to solve the poverty problem and the school funding problem at the same time, we're probably not going to get anywhere. Because the reality is there are so many Republicans that aren't going to participate in the solution here that you have to have some Democrats.
Well, I'm not going to pretend to speak for all Democrats, but I think there is a solution at hand where Democrats would vote for a very clean ballot initiative on this. And I think if it were structured in a way that it was the taxes were raised for, if we got back some of the $1.8 billion that we gave to corporations 4 years ago.
Well, that's been the Democratic message since last night, that, you know, even Democratic leaders who, you know, went for this deal, Tim Grimmel, who, you know, and supported it and backed it, you know, today we're tagging this as a Republican failure, a Republican loss, voter rejection of Republican policies, and they are now calling for new corporate taxes. I mean, that's the new party line.
Let's get really political, and by that terms, I mean just sort of awful, because it would be wonderful, right, if the roads were fixed, it would be great. But let's dig in a little deeper here, and that is this, that in order to get this Proposal 1 on the ballot, Governor Snyder needed Democrats, and he made some deals with some Ds. He likes
not just Democrats. Remember that this stalled in the Senate.
Yes.
and it failed by one vote to get on the ballot.
Yeah.
And the vote that turned was not a Democratic vote.
Indeed.
It was a Republican vote.
Indeed.
Mike Green from the Thumb,
yeah,
who made a deal to get his gun bill voted,
yeah,
on.
Yeah, very true. But what I want to look at here is the Democrats who made this deal. They said, okay, you know, we're going to vote for it, and for that, we're going to get some money for education as part of it. We're going to have an increase in the end earned income tax credit. I guess what I want to know, Joe, from you, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about, how bummed, I mean, really, are Democrats, even who want a roads fix, that this went down? I mean, doesn't this put them in a bit of a new power position?
Don't the Republicans
position
have to come back and deal with them even more?
Particularly
now?
Governor Snyder.
Well, I think
Snyder.
Democratic legislators' hand is strengthened by what happened yesterday. To go back to your earlier question, I don't think any Democrat's going to lose in a primary based on their vote to put this on the ballot, whereas on the other side, it very well could easily happen.
Well, and let's give a shout-out to Dave Eggert at the Associated Press, who I think it was 2 weeks ago now, gave a quick survey, three questions, mind you, to every single lawmaker, Senate, House, 148 lawmakers, simply asking, are you going to vote on Prop 1? How are you going to vote? So these are your lawmakers. He heard back from 23% of them. So that wasn't even like 23% saying yes, 70% saying no. This was 23% of your lawmakers just willing to say whether or not they were planning on voting Prop 1. So that, I think, tells you something.
If my math is correct, that's 77% saying none of your business. That's unacceptable.
I think that's what I'm getting at here. Okay, let's take some more questions, please.
I raised my hand with a mouthful.
Take your time.
I better not. My name is Christine.
Hi, Christine.
I live in Grand Rapids.
Hi.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about energy policy, which is being discussed in Lansing right now, and talk about... It's come up, I know. And hopefully they're talking about it. And talk about mandates and the stranglehold that DTE has and Consumers Energy has on our energy and the possibility of getting some mandates for alternative energy. Just all of energy policy.
Yeah, because we can answer that in like 2 minutes.
unlike Proposal 1, energy policy is easy. There are no, there's no complexity there.
Well, so Rick, why don't you quickly, before we jump into the politics of it, because there are politics about it, why don't you try to, in a minute, explain where Representative Nesbitt, who is doing some energy policy issues, what some of the bills that Republicans are talking about right now, sort of what the issue is, and then we'll try to jump into the politics.
I would say that energy policy kind of falls into three areas of conversation on them. And one of them is the environmental one. Is our energy policy actually green and non-polluting? That's the one that gets pushed to the back of the line first when we start talking about the other two, which are reliability and affordability. Brownouts, are the lights going to come on when you flip the switch? And we really do have, and by the way, I say that Ken is an expert on this, that he's been working on this at Public Sector Consultants, and he can tell you about, his dog in that fight. But, what we have right now is kind of a mishmash energy policy where some customers can leave for competitors who don't even have to guarantee that they can provide the service if there's a problem, while the incumbent utilities, the big players, DTE, Consumers Power, that they not only have to, provide the service to their existing customers, but they have to have enough, excess capacity that if those challengers, if those, other companies, if they can't do the job, if the customers have to leave for any reason and come back, then the incumbent utility still has to be able to service them, that they still have to have enough capacity, hanging around for just that reason. We actually ran into that in the Upper Peninsula, where, and by the way, because our Upper Peninsula lawmakers are very good at what they do, one in particular, Tom Casperson. They actually, created a carve out for mining companies so that they're never covered by the cap, so they can just, come and go as they please, no matter what. A mining company left, and the incumbent utility up there still had to keep enough excess capacity around in case they return. And they're like, we can't do that. You know, it's just not physically possible for us to keep, you know, remain, you know, keep our doors open.
Okay, so that's reliability. So, now let's get into affordability.
And, I mean, that's where green energy and affordability sometimes, you know, butt up against each other, especially when it comes to the upfront costs. But, you know, people want energy that they, you know, want it to be reliable, that, but they also, you know, get really ticked off when big energy bills arrive in their mailbox. And we know that they're not going to get they're not going to get smaller. So those are all the things that are in play. So we've got Governor Snyder, who says that he favors, you know, a quote unquote, all of the above strategy, which is a pretty common Republican line on energy policy, which is you kind of, you know, go everywhere where it's most convenient. We've got the chair of the House Energy Committee who's saying, you know what, we just need to return back to a system where the incumbent utilities, you know, keep their market dominance. And then everyone who's sort of, you know, everyone else is kind of in the middle saying that we need to at least keep the amount of competition that we have or maybe boost it a little bit, you know, and so everyone is somewhere in that continuum. I think I probably broke your 1 minute rule.
By like nine. And considering that we are not, we are, it's just politics, not it's just policy.
It's not, it's just policy.
Let's get into
well,
it.
Well, can I, the back can room I, over there.
Yeah.
After Rick has butchered the answer, can I try?
Okay, everyone take all of that back.
I think the lady's question was about more renewable energy, is how I took it. And my view is that Michigan is going to generate more electricity from renewable sources in the future than we have in the past. And the reason for that is not because Republican majorities in Lansing really are enthused about more wind and solar. It's really because the EPA has changed the game through various regulations that are clamping down on emissions. And what that means is that utilities, consumers, and DTE primarily, in the future, they are simply forced, in order to meet these guidelines from a statewide perspective, they've got to find more sources that emit less carbon. And that basically
means... As they close
means,
coal plants.
It means natural gas and wind right now. So I just think that... You know, and I keep hearing and reading about the war on coal. Well, if there's a war on coal, coal is losing or has lost. It's over. It's going to be more renewable, more efficiency, and then a lot more natural gas in the future, and that's going to be better for future generations.
And Joe, we do have a renewable energy mandate in the state, and we're very close to meeting it. In fact, most environmentalists... No, you're laughing.
Well, no, I'm laughing because what's coming up next is DTE is going to go to the voters and try to put something on the ballot next year to protect their market share. I mean, something's going on. There's the reason all these feel-good DTE commercials are up on the air. They're laying the groundwork for something.
Joe, you're crazy.
I've heard
just
that.
Just crazy. Not going to happen.
Okay, let's go to some more questions, please.
Ken, this is for you. If John Engler were governor today, how would he deal with the Tea Party? This is sort of a philosophical
great question.
But that man knew how to manipulate, maybe that's a harsh word. He knew a perfect word. Manipulate legislators and get what he wanted. How would he deal with Tea Party people? These people are, in my mind, nuts. But anyway.
Well, I already said somebody here was crazy, but I know Joe's not part of the Tea Party. Let me say this about... let me answer your question this way. And I was in the legislature during John's entire 12 years. And a lot of people think that the secret to John Engler's success was his, you know, sort of his meanness or his toughness or his whatever. And really, the secret to his success was that he knew more than anybody else in the room on every single issue you talked about.
That was the secret to his success. And then number two is, unlike the current governor and unlike Governor Granholm, he relished the legislative inside, getting the votes. How do you motivate legislators? Because he was a product of that environment. He spent 20 years in the legislature, and he loved it. He loved the challenge of how to find 56 in the House, 20 in the Senate. And it didn't matter if Democrats controlled the House or not. When he was governor, they controlled the House during much of that time. But his knowledge and his enthusiasm and the way he relished the legislative infight was his secret.
That's a fabulous answer.
Yeah. No, he was also willing to identify a potential, on the Republican side, he was very willing to identify potential primary opponents for any Republicans who did not cooperate.
But there was some substance behind the bluster and the threats. Yeah. Well, and otherwise, the bluster and the threats are just hot air.
There's an interesting parallel. You know, I mean, Bill Clinton obviously didn't work in the legislature, but I think you saw that same kind of love for the game. And I think there are some who say this is why President Obama hasn't been able to get enough of his agenda passed, is because he doesn't relish that. He doesn't
well,
like
and working. We have a governor who has a disdain for the game.
Right. And says, I'm not a career politician.
Well, once you take the oath of office, you're a politician.
Fair enough. And once you speculate on rumors about the White House,
Joe is right about Governor Snyder. I'm a big supporter of Governor Snyder. I voted for him twice, but he clearly, you know, coming from the world he came from, he just does not like spending time with legislators. And, I sort of don't blame him, but
I was going to say, and that's a bad thing.
Well, but you know what? Then don't get into politics, because that's how we get things done in this country.
But I would also have the same criticism for Governor Granholm.
I agreed there, too.
Because I was majority leader when she was governor, and so I had to deal with her every day. And
it was like a moving target.
Yeah, and let me give you an example, if I may,
please,
if we have the
please.
Time. You know, I talked about John Engler's relishing this. I remember a time where John wanted my vote on a big issue, and I was on a committee that was dealing with it, and it was during the Christmas season, lame duck, and he brought me into his office, and he kept me there for 7 hours. And I am not exaggerating. He kept me and another legislator who was as recalcitrant as I was on this issue, he kept us in his conference room for 7 hours. You know, we could leave and, you know, go to the restroom. He brought in food. But until he got what he wanted. Now, what he got at the end wasn't what he wanted at the beginning. It's not like my way or the highway.
He got something done.
You know, he compromised. Now, let's fast forward. I also remember a similar situation with Governor Granholm. Very tough issue. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she asked myself and the Republican speaker to come into her conference room to talk about this issue. We show up. She comes in. It's 4 o'clock. She says, we got to solve this issue. I've got a half hour. And then I got to go to another event. I looked at the speaker, and he looked at me and said, we can sit here for a half hour. And we didn't solve the problem. Just an example of two very different governors, one, I would say, much more effective than the other.
Let's take some more questions.
It's your turn. Make it a good one.
You know I always do. Hi, Nathan here from Grand Rapids, and just a couple things about the road. So,
Nathan,
I
adore you, and you've been to these issues and ales before. So let's pick one issue about the roads.
Okay, sure. So I don't know
Nathan
if anyone
is politically, you know, politically active. So let's pick
I'm
one
I'm
issue.
I'm informed.
Okay.
I read some stuff.
I know.
I don't know if anyone here has read about. I don't know if anyone here has read about the I-94 widening in Detroit. It's a $1.8 billion project. I wish you guys had someone from MDOT. Unfortunately, I don't, you know, whatever, that's known from MDOT to answer, but that seems like a big pile of money that could be used to fund other roads, seeing as no one wants that expansion. It was based on 20-year-old data. None of the traffic that they predicted in the 1990s has appeared. A couple other funding sources, the big debacle, that Capitol View, the new building for the Michigan legislature, $134 million. Has anyone heard of that? And number three, hadn't been brought up yet, is the truck weight limits. That would have been an easy one to put in.
She said one.
That would save our roads. So we got a couple
things. You're
killing
me here, dude. You're killing me. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about weight limits. The I-94 issue is interesting. I think it probably pertains a little less to Grand Rapids. I'm going to do a little love for stateside. We've covered that issue a lot. MichiganRadio.org, check it out. But let's talk a little bit about weight limits, because I would like to get back to Prop 1. There's two things I want to talk about, is this idea of weight limits, and the second is warranties for the folks that are actually building the roads. That there has been a lot of talk from people who say, you know, we see our roads, someone's making them better, 3 years later, they're back again at the same road, or at the same roads trying to fix it. Joe, this ballot was going to you know, kind of help with some of those issues. Do you see a legislative solution separate from the ballot that will happen?
I think warranties and guarantees on quality of roads need to be a part of the solution. It was on the ballot yesterday. I would hope that whenever eventual solution we get to, and we'll get to one, whether it's in 5 days or 5 years, we will get to a solution. I think a point that I want folks to hear that I haven't really heard talked about too much is this idea that yesterday was a referendum on any tax increase at all.
Yeah.
I fully expected a lot of collateral damage in school elections that occurred yesterday.
Yeah.
And more importantly, renewals. You know? So some of my Republican friends are from the Tea Party or Libertarian faction, and they're pushing this line, this talking point that yesterday was a referendum on taxes in general, and I just don't believe that's the case. The reason I'm answering the question this way is because people want value for those tax dollars. They want the warranties and guarantees so that we're not back here, you know, filling up a hole in 3 years.
Two things about warranties, though. One is that, you know, warranties were a part of, you know, road policy before the ballot question. It was just included in there. But the other dirty little secret about warranties is they only work if you save more money by, you know, enforcing the warranty than it costs to enforce the warranty. And it actually costs a lot more in many instances to bird dog the contractors on that than it does to actually do the repair.
That would have MDOT do a lot more monitoring?
Yes, there absolutely was. Yeah.
Well, it's right now MDOT is very aggressively doing that, and one of the problems they're running into is that they're doing it more aggressively than any other state in the country, and so when it comes to warranties, Michigan is in a state of experimentation.
And
that we don't know what works yet, what doesn't.
Oh, we definitely are in a state of experimentation.
Yeah.
And in terms of weight limits, I'm going to steal a line from Susan Demas, your wife, Joe DeSano, who says, look, you know, Michigan, we are a peninsula. And so we have these low truck weight limits because we want drivers to go through I-94. This is what the convenience stores, this is what gas stations, this is what we want. Otherwise, they're not going to go through Michigan. And so in order to suddenly change weight limits, you've got a lot of lobbyists that are going, wait, 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 no, no, no.
I actually hadn't heard her make that argument.
Oh.
It's a pretty good one.
Sometimes we just have girl nights and we braid each other's hair and we just talk about weight limits.
Whoa, now we're talking.
Okay, let's go to some more questions.
I'm
going to
unleash my inner shock jack.
It's a little too awkward. I'm Okay.
Well, so, if you're talking a $2 billion annual solution, $134 million is a very, very small part.
Oh, are you talking about the Senate office building?
About the Senate office.
Yeah, the Senate office building. The boondoggle.
And we are going to hear more about that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but let's look, we need to face facts here. Look, have the best warranties in the world. Change the truck limits. Forget 94 down at Detroit. Easy for me to say from Granville. You know, don't move the Senate offices. The fact of the matter is you still need more money to fix the roads. I mean, that is a fact
of
life.
$2 billion
every year.
Annually for about 15 years.
So, right, every year.
You know, and I remember back in 1997 when, you know, we in the legislature, before we raised the gas tax, we said the same thing. We said, God, all we got to do is do better warranties. And, you know, let's do a study on these truck limits because that's got to be the problem. And you know, there's way too much money, by the way, going down to Southeast Michigan. Let's have some money here in West Michigan for the roads. The fact of the matter is
they are quite nice. Congratulations. Well, you did your job.
You know,
there is a market difference.
That's right. So, I mean, there's just, you know, once again, people want to be in denial here about what you have to do ultimately, the bottom line here. And until we go through denial and get to acceptance, we're going to be in trouble.
How much of this, though, I mean, also has to do with voters? And this is not a very popular thing to say. But again, okay, we saw 25% voter turnout yesterday. What was it, 46% turnout in November for the election, the gubernatorial election, the Senate election? You know, it obviously goes higher when there's a
president.
Well, the
May election, we're looking at 24%, you know, voter turnout, registered voter turnout. Yeah. We're going, wow.
Right, right. I guess what I'm trying to dig into, though, is this idea that, yes, lawmakers are to blame. Yes, most folks are angry at lawmakers. Congress has an approval rate that I think now is a negative numbers. We like to be mad at our lawmakers, and maybe this isn't the audience that I should be talking to, right? Like, we're here tonight talking politics on just an evening and getting into policy. But how much of this has to do with the citizenry and voters? Because everyone's mad, but we're not changing things, and we have the power to change.
Well, let me posit this, that, you know, it is a regular occurrence on the campaign trail that our politicians, our governor has certainly done this, run against a, quote, broken political culture. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not working. It's not working in Lansing. It's not working in Washington. And then they're surprised when the public's reaction to something like a Proposal 1 isn't, you know what, I mean, we put it together. It's the best we can do. Trust us.
Yeah.
You can't run a 35-year campaign about the ineffectiveness of government and then expect people to think that government can actually solve a problem.
Okay, I want to bring up this Twitter question. Because we're, like, just super cool like that. We can actually do that right now. So Colin on Twitter, this looks like 140 characters more, but okay. In other words, are Republicans too concerned about 2016 to deal with roads outside the ballot box? And then Tansy says, too worried about elections. So I think it's still getting back to this idea of lawmakers being a little too worried about themselves.
But isn't that the way the system is supposed to work?
But they're not worried about general elections. They're worried about primary elections, which are an entirely different animal.
Yeah.
True,
yeah.
True. Yeah.
Well, I want to put a little different perspective on that.
Please.
While you're here.
You know, clearly, I mean, I think we all understand that the sort of political dynamic, if that means elections and running and being successful, that's been part of the American system since 1776, and that's part of our electoral system. I mean, and that's a given. I think a big difference is, and I can only relate my own personal experience, is when I voted for the gas tax in 1997, do you think I really wanted to vote for the gas tax increase? No. But it was prior to term limits, and I felt that I had built up enough political capital back in my district that even the people that disagreed with me on the issue would at least say, you know, I trust him, I know him, he's going to look at all sides, I don't agree with him, but I felt I had amassed enough political capital to spend it on an issue that the state needed to be solved.
And you were reelected.
Yeah. And I think with term limits, I think one of the problems with term limits is that when you're not there long enough to build this political capital, you've got nothing to spend on a tough issue. And that's one of my biggest criticisms of term limits is not so much the lack of experience. You know, I mean, that's an issue, I guess, but it's the inability to build the political capital with your constituency that you need to spend every once in a while.
And this is what we hear over and over again, and yet term limits among folks remain quite popular. Because on the outside, it seems really great, right? Let's get these folks out before they come too entrenched. But what we know now is that most lobbyists have a larger amount of knowledge than a lot of lawmakers do. We're not creating the relationships in order to compromise that used to happen.
And yet they're so popular that the only way you could ever get a term limits, you know, a repeal or extension to pass was to do, you know, something even worse to politicians. Like instead of 6-year terms in the House, they could have 12-year terms, but at the end we execute them.
Well, or then we're talking about ideas like the part-time legislature and things like that. Although Randy Richardville, who had your job, Ken, up until this past end of December, had floated an idea that maybe there would be some kind of extension to term limits, that a lawmaker might be able to run another couple terms if they went out into their district.
That was called the Randy Richardville Employment Act.
No, but you know what? But here's the thing, Joe. When I asked Randy, because we were talking about this, and I said, well, right, that's what everyone's going to think, is that you're doing this for yourself. And he said, no, if we actually passed this, I would make a commitment right now that I would not run again.
Yeah, well, he also said he wouldn't vote for right to work.
It wasn't on his agenda either. Okay, who else is... Yeah.
Hi there. I'm Phil from Jenison.
Hi.
And, okay, I know we're talking about roads, fixing them.
Hey, we're talking about whatever you want to talk about.
And that's like a price tag of $1 billion. A little smaller on that, though, and it's been proven in the ballot, is marijuana, legalizing it, taxing it. And
pot for potholes.
Right. It's worked in Colorado. And what's the percentage tax on that over there? Like just under 3%?
I don't know, but I know like a year it's making about, I think, $80 million, I think.
Yeah, although marijuana revenue is becoming like the new tobacco settlement windfalls that you know, everyone's looking at it and going, oh, I could use it for this or we could use it for that. I mean, it would not be enough to do a complete road fix.
Right, but what's the political atmosphere concerning such a proposal?
Actually,
as good as it's ever been, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, the legislature is looking...
Its prospects are high.
Yeah. Tip your servers.
Joe's going to be here all night. Just flew in, and boy, are his arms tired.
You know, right now there are a lot of entities that are, you know, looking at exactly that question, and they're looking at, you know, relaxing rules on, you know, medical marijuana, dispensaries and things like that, because they see the whole, you know, legalization, decriminalization effort as having some legs. I'm not sure it's stoppable.
Well, I think what you're going to see is at least one of the three proposals make the ballot in 2016. And if we can get just one of them on the ballot instead of two, where they cancel each other out perhaps, you could have full legalization here in the state of Michigan in 2017.
And there's Jeff Irwin in Ann Arbor, a Democratic legislator who's really made that an issue. We had Mike Calton, so it's interesting bedfellows, right? You've got some libertarians, some Republicans, as well as Democrats who are actually working together bipartisanly on an issue. Okay, we got some more questions, it looks like. Yeah.
Hey, my name's Laura.
Hi, Laura.
I love you guys so much.
We heart you, too, Laura.
We're fans of you, too.
Oh, well, thanks. This is not a super well-thought-out question, but I work in education, so I'd like to hear a little bit about where that's headed, I guess, in the wake of Prop 1 not passing.
Can I just ask you, so are you a teacher?
I work in higher ed.
Okay.
Yep, I work at Grand Valley.
Okay, great.
Let's talk, I guess, maybe first about the budget that the State House, the State Senate have both passed omnibus budgets, which also, separate from that, are the school aid fund budgets. Of course, in the last gubernatorial race over the summer, education cuts, particularly K through 12 education cuts, did he or didn't he? Speaking about Governor Snyder, cut $1 billion. That became a huge, huge issue.
When we're looking at... As the legislature casts about for dollars, you know, it's like, you know, why do robbers rob banks? Because that's where the money is. You know, that they're going to look, and they're going to look for places where there is discretionary money, absent some change in laws or the Constitution that allows them to raid those dedicated funds.
That was actually on the ballot yesterday.
In Prop 1, which I don't think anyone knew that actually, Prop 1, that was part of it, that you would not be able to take money from the school aid fund
for higher education, for universities. Yeah. So there's money in universities, there's money in revenue sharing, there's money in corrections, and there is possibly some money in healthcare. Yeah. And so, I mean, they're all going to be on the table. Will they be gutted? No. But, I could envision a scenario where, you know, they scrape from here and there to, try and find money maybe to make, you know, enough for the federal matching funds for transportation.
Ken, I would love your perspective, though, when it comes to Republicans, and I think there is this narrative in the state, whether it's fair or not, that the Republicans in the state legislature right now, Governor Snyder, that they are anti-public education, that they are doing everything they can to gut public K through 12, that, you know, it's all about, you know, charters and online virtual schools. Is you know, how much of that is fair, that there are some real big policy changes going on, and how much is that Democrats and teachers' unions really making an issue out of some cuts that we've seen?
I think a couple of observations. I mean, education is sort of a big area. The funding of education, whether it's higher ed, community colleges, local public schools, that will always be an issue every year, okay? I think if you peel the onion back a little bit, the big issues in education at the Capitol right now are the situation in Detroit, with schools in Detroit, a statewide teacher evaluation system that is similar to what other states have done to try to boost learning. The governor has proposed some initiatives to try to target third grade reading proficiency. I think those are some of the big issues in education aside from the annual budget issue. Now, I will answer your question, but you thought I wasn't going to.
I trusted it.
Is it fair to criticize Republicans for cutting education?
Let's let the man answer.
And once again, I want to give you a little perspective on it. I think it is fair to say, in order to balance the budget in his first year in office, that's 2011, that there were cuts to education. It's a fair criticism. But let me point out that the state was facing, and had been facing, a structural deficit of $1.7 billion year in and year out that had to be solved. Now, do you agree with the way Rick Snyder and the Republicans in Lansing solved it? Obviously, some of you don't. A lot of people don't. I think it is fair to say that there were cuts to education that they have worked, I guess, to undo, meaning putting more money into education, both higher ed and the K-12 system since then. But I think it's a fair criticism. It is a departure from what Republicans historically have done. We always tried to protect education during budget challenges. But they did what they did. That's why they did it. And it's time to move on.
Okay. Any more questions? Yeah. Oh, we got one back there, and then we'll go to you. Yeah.
My name's Adam. I'm from around here.
Hi, Adam.
First of all, I've never agreed with Republicans so much in my entire life, so thanks for surprising me today. My main question, however, is why was Prop 1, why was the main focus a regressive tax on it? Like, it seems doomed to fail from the very beginning, so why wasn't there some other
because that was the one? Because that was the best they could do, that they looked at fuel taxes, they looked at registration fees.
That the answer? Why is that the best way to go? Because it seems terribly unfair.
First, I just want to be clear that everyone understands what a regressive tax is, because I think sometimes there's some confusion about that. So that's the idea that increasing the sales tax by one percentage point.
Because it's a flat rate, it falls more heavily on people with lower incomes as a percentage of their household income than it does on households with higher incomes. And that's why Democrats made a deal to bring a restoration of the earned income tax credit to be part of it. And a big part of it was that it would have to go on the ballot. And when the leadership couldn't get a deal for an actual road funding plan through the legislature, that one of the arguments, and Ken can speak to this better than I can, one of the arguments that you can make is, we're not asking you to approve a tax increase, Representative so-and-so, Senator so-and-so. We're asking you to let the voters decide whether to approve a tax increase. And because the sales tax rate is in the state constitution, that has to go to the ballot. Did I butcher that?
No, it's the sales tax is a regressive tax. It's hard to answer your question because there are so many moving parts to it. From a Republicans traditionally resist raising the income tax, in part based on economic theory that long term to an economy, raising the income tax is more harmful than any consumption tax. But clearly a consumption tax is going to be regressive. Now, another Republican argument in favor of using a sales tax is that in Michigan, you don't have it on food and medicine. So it is less regressive than it would normally be. But it is a regressive tax, and there's an age-old battle between Republicans and Democrats on whether or not you use a sales tax or an income tax to fund government. And going back to Proposal A of 1994, which I alluded to earlier, in order to solve the school funding problem, that was the choice, and voters got to make that choice. Do you want to raise a sales tax from 4% to 6%, or do you want to raise the income tax? And they were given the option, and the voters picked the sales tax.
And the income tax is, for Republicans, is typically the less attractive option. It's considered something of an ambition or an entrepreneurial tax. And also, Republicans typically favor a flat rate as opposed to some kind of a tiered tax.
Hi. So if we could go back, Steve from Grand Rapids.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. So first-time visitor, long-time listener. So if we could,
Us too.
Hey. So I really understand, the passion that all of us have regarding all the issues and so forth. And sometimes we're just led, by that passion. But if we could get back a little bit to maybe some facts. So it's so easy to harp on government either side when they reduce funding for a certain initiative. And we're talking a few minutes ago about education in Michigan and the $1 billion or whatever the number was. But what were the actual results of that period? What happened to the scholastic test scores? And what happened to graduation rates and so forth? To really look at the data would help me and maybe others really understand the impact of that short-term decision to help write a really bad budget. for example?
Well, I mean, I think what your question is that the fundamentals of, like, let's actually look at the numbers. Michigan Radio, and again, I'm going to do a little shout-out for that. We just did an entire series in-depth. We had, I think, 17 journalists at Michigan Radio end up working on this, and this was called Learning to Teach. And as well as the State of Opportunity team at Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer, who lives here in Grand Rapids, works on it. Lindsay Smith, the West Michigan reporter that probably everyone has seen at a bar around here, around, because she's just incredible.
What are you trying to say?
She's what, like, what are we getting at there? I didn't even mean it like that. She's out and about. She's constantly talking to folks. She's got a drinking problem, too. I'm just saying. No, actually, poor Lindsay was going to be here tonight. She's sick, though, which is a total bummer. But this is the reporting.
Yeah, it's from hanging out at all those bars.
But this is the reporting that they're doing, and you know, we do interviews on stateside, right, with Adam Zemke, who's a representative who's talking right now about teacher evaluations. I mean, I will say right now,
And Lisa Posthumous Lyons has been big on that.
Yeah, I mean, I will say one of the hard things right now when it actually comes, if you want to look at how students are doing on test scores, is the fact that Michigan doesn't really have great data for like the past decade on that, because we've been changing how we do tests. Joe and I were talking about this earlier, that we had the MEEP, and then there's Common Core, and now there's M-STEP, and then next year there's going to be something different. So, I mean, if you want to look at the facts and figures, I mean, I think you guys would probably agree that right now public schools classrooms are larger, right?
And people will also argue about whether or not those test scores even are measuring the things that they ought to be measuring, or whether they're measuring them accurately. You know, when I arrived in Lansing, the same time that Ken arrived in Lansing, people were dissatisfied with student testing. It was a huge controversy.
Yeah.
And with every change, every permutation of student testing, there's still been just this widespread dissatisfaction with how student performance is measured. And I think there will always be widespread dissatisfaction with how student performance is measured based on you know, whatever it is they're measuring at that moment.
But I would say, again, that we've got some reporters who are doing nothing but looking into those numbers and doing nothing but analyzing that. And so I would tell you to go check out some of the stories that they're doing. And I think what they show is that classrooms are getting larger. I think teachers have more students, that there's sometimes fewer resources. The issue is a lot of money is going to teacher retirement. That's something that folks are going to have to work on. And so these are some more policy issues that the education committees in the state house, in the Senate, the school board, the state superintendent, the governor, all are working on. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tom from East Grand Rapids, where
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for bringing a question, because we were dangerously close to starting to talk about legacy costs. So.
I'll try to spice it up a little bit. So yesterday in East Grand Rapids, almost 64% of the people voted for a dedicated property tax for the roads. And a year ago, the city of Grand Rapids residents voted for an income tax extension for roads. In Ottawa County, they voted a county property tax last year for the roads. I'm thinking the residents around here understand how critical it is to, you know, to the business climate, to quality of life in terms of competitive cities and also tourism. So we all seem to get those classic Republican arguments. You know, the chambers of commerce generally are, you know, desperate for something to be done. How come the Republicans, and maybe it's the Tea Party faction, which seems to be most of them, why don't they go along with those traditional Republican support for a positive business climate? What has changed? It just baffles me. Yeah, just like in Oklahoma, I can't imagine the Republican leadership not doing everything possible to make that state as competitive as possible. It's just a cutthroat environment out there for talent, for capital. I don't understand it.
It's a little ironic, but in my experience, and this is a bit anecdotal, but West Michiganders, I think, have a lot more confidence in their government than maybe the larger public public does. Now, they don't have a lot of confidence in other people's government and who they elect.
But doesn't that go in general to politics? I mean, all politics is local, and what's the saying, the re-elect me, that person, but not the person under the tree? What does that
mean? It's don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax that guy behind the tree.
Yeah, but it's also this idea that, you trust your own congressperson, that overall, the D.C., as I said, approval rating is negative numbers, but when you actually look at your local congressperson, your local rep or state rep, you tend to give them much higher.
I just think that's even more true in this part of the state than it is in most other parts of the state.
Well, since I'm...
Ken, what's in the water here?
Since I'm the token Republican up here, let me take a shot at answering this gentleman's question. There are two things you said in your question that lead us to the answer. One is these were local initiatives, and there's just a higher level of confidence in local government versus state or national government. I mean, in fact, you can see it in terms of the question in polling of, who do you trust or whatever, higher level of trust locally, much less in Lansing, and then it plummets off the cliff in Washington. So, and that's because people are closer to the local government. They know where City Hall is. The city council people, the mayor, they're neighbors. And so you have more access, more confidence, more input. These were local initiatives. Secondly, as you pointed out, they were all dedicated to roads. Every single one of those was dedicated to roads. Prop 1 wasn't dedicated to roads. It was dedicated to a variety of things, which, and on top of that, voters were told it was for roads, and then they found out it wasn't. I mean, my goodness. I mean, I'm surprised the pitchforks didn't show up in Lansing over this. But I think in your question, we can sort of see the core of an answer. If you and I went to Lansing today and we pulled out Republicans from the House and the Senate, they would agree with what you said. Fixing our roads is critical to economic development long term. But I would point out that even the Michigan Chamber of Commerce sat this one out. They didn't support Prop 1 because of all these other things that were in it. So there's not a dispute over your premise about the importance of good roads to economic growth, but this proposal was fraught with disaster.
And also to Joe's point, that across the state that we saw proposal 1 go down, but a lot of local millages and millage renewals were approved.
Okay, yeah.
I've got a question. It seems like the Republican Party is interested in finding ways to find waste and cut the budget so that they don't have to raise taxes. I'm a senior citizen. I'm on a fixed income. I'd be more than happy to pay taxes. I don't have to pay school taxes, which is a crime. Why haven't the Republicans...
You do pay school taxes every time you buy something.
I guess I need to spend more. We got a Republican legislature.
Let's start tonight. Rounds for all.
A Republican governor. Why haven't they found all these things that save us from raising taxes to save the budget? We've got roads that are shot. We've got bridges that are shot. We've got an education system that is in the tank and needs serious work. And we need to support public radio. So we're...
Let's find this man a tote bag.
Yeah. Nina tote bag. So haven't they found all the problems in the budget that are fraud and graft and wastage?
Waste, fraud, and abuse.
To pay, yeah, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
There's not that much left.
Yeah. And this is Charlie Ballard is an economist at Michigan State University that we have on Michigan Radio a lot, wrote the book on Michigan's economy, I think called like Michigan's Economy. And I mean, I think there is this idea, right, that this was even happening in the Granholm years. So this is not a Republican or a Democratic issue, but we had a great recession. You know, this happened all over the country, and Michigan felt it really, really bad. And so we cut.
We felt it before anyone else did.
What is it that the country sneezes and Michigan gets a the flu or something like that?
It just occurred to me that a copy of Charlie's book is in my bedroom, which sadly may be a comment that I probably should have kept myself.
Sorry. We're not going there.
Yeah, if you want to borrow a copy, go to Joe's bedroom, I think is what he's getting at.
Oh, I didn't read it.
there's this idea, though, of Charlie Ballard's, which is that we've cut and we've cut and we've cut. And some will argue because we had to, right, that there was no other way. But at a certain point, you cut to the bone. And I think some would argue we're at the bone. Some would argue we were at the bone 5 years ago. Some would argue we're not quite there yet. Some would argue, why does it matter once we hit the bone?
Well, the other thing, too, is that if you wait until, you know, you've cut every instance of, you know, waste, fraud, you know, duplication, whatever, before you go out and fund the other things that you need to do, you'll never do the other things that you need to do.
And waste, fraud, and abuse, and this is a sexy term in D.C. and here in Michigan, the idea that that's how we can fund things. Rick, over the 2014 election, we did a series of Michigan callings. So they weren't quite debates, but we did hour-long conversations with those who are running for governor, those who are running for the U.S. Senate. And Rick really pressed Mark Schauer on this because Schauer was pushing for all of these things he was going to do. He was going to restore all the education cuts. He was going to fix road funding, all of these grand ideas, which sounded lovely.
The super audit.
Right. And Rick said, okay, how do you pay for it? And Mark Schauer's answer was, well, you go through every department, right, and you figure out waste, fraud, and abuse. And the idea that you would be able to, you know, pay for roads $2 billion a year, that you'd be able to increase education $1 billion a year somehow because you'd find some accounting gimmicks, which absolutely are happening in certain departments, but that's the easiest answer. And yet, again, that doesn't get us anywhere close to the money that's needed to fund some of the initiatives that voters seem to want.
Well, and the question was rooted in this, which was, I'm sorry? Okay, but
yes, we do. Yeah. I'll say it.
Another question back
and
there.
We've only got a few. I'm getting the, how many more minutes? Okay, I'm getting the wrap-up slide, so let's take three more questions, how about?
Okay. Mine's a little off-topic, so I apologize, but it's
there
about
is
voter
no
turnout.
Topic.
All right.
My favorite color is green, or was it different?
My name is Amanda, and I'm from Grand Rapids, and yesterday was my first day working as an election worker in a precinct here in Grand Rapids.
Congratulations.
And I was...
You brought the average age down
to 86.
Everybody
can do it. It's pretty easy. primaries are coming up soon, so go ahead and call up the clerk's office. But I actually, I was curious when I was working the polls, and we ended up with 13% voter turnout in the precinct that I worked. And I, by the end of the day, was excited that we had one person that came in right at 7:59 and made that 13%. But it really was disappointing to me at the same time. I've been an avid voter since I was able to vote. And I wonder if there is any movement to change the way that we vote in the world and in our society today. I know a lot of other, maybe not a lot of other, but some other states have gone to absentee votes being available more
other
frequently.
Other countries make it a national holiday.
Exactly. And I just wonder if we're moving that way here in Michigan or on a national level even.
If it's going to happen, it's going to be very incremental.
And this is something, you know, we've got Ruth Johnson, who's a Republican Secretary of State right now, and there's been a lot of talk about letting Michigan be completely absentee ballot, that right now there's some things not everyone can be an absentee ballot voter.
Technically, but pretty much anyone who really wants to vote absentee can.
If you're willing to lie. Right. I mean, if you're willing to lie, right?
It
says if you're going to be out of town, you've got to be, is it over 60
or 65?
You think
you might be, you think you're likely to be out of town.
Yeah. But there is absolutely a push for that. And there are, like I was saying, other countries that turn it into a national holiday. There's a historical story about
voting
unions.
Voting periods where people can show up at their local clerk
right, that
and
it's
vote
not
for
just
a period of time.
One day.
There's a whole series of changes and initiatives we can make if you want people to vote. There are a very large group of people in control of the state capitol who want to keep the turnout as low as possible, to limit the possibilities, to control the outcomes.
Is that a fair statement, Ken? Do you think? I mean, there's this issue between, you know, voter access versus
versus ballot security.
Yeah.
No.
There is no voter fraud being done. Okay, not in a big enough manner to
okay,
register.
Okay, I think I
yeah,
said,
we're
so we got
time,
two
so
questions
question.
Yeah. left. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Linda from Grand Rapids.
Hi, Linda.
And I clearly have an interest in the roads being in good shape because they're just tearing
Linda's
my car
wearing
apart.
An Uber t-shirt.
So. Uber driver. I'm also, that's also an independent contractor job, so I own my own little business. And I had an appraisal firm for 20 years before I retired, did this. Because, when it came to the business tax, I paid it all the years I was in business and didn't have a problem with it. Was surprised that they cut it. It doesn't look like they can tie any benefit to the fact that they did cut it. Can we go back and say we made a mistake and put that back in? Because it's the businesses that are clearly benefiting from the roads statewide being in really good shape. Just my thought.
I don't see any changes anytime soon to the MBT.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the now it's the CIT, the corporate income tax.
Yeah, I with Republicans in charge, I think that was settled. I think
they done that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's. What's the last question?
Last one. A lot of pressure here.
Make
I'm
it
Ryan
good.
Rapids.
Don't let us down.
Yeah, I'm wondering what the political experts' opinion would be on for the what they think. We need a solution. So, what's going to be Plan B, and how long they think it will last? That's it.
Well, I mean, you mean on the roads? Well, I mean, whatever they do, typically road funding solutions last, what would you say, 15, 20 years? No, we've also got, I mean, transportation is changing. That, you know, right now we rely a lot on fuel taxes, but we're, you know, fewer young people are buying cars. Fewer cars use fossil fuels. So, I mean, we are going to be, you know, confronted with, you know, we are going to be confronted
yeah,
with the
requirement
that we change.
Yeah, I think Rick and I did a story, you know, why your Prius is you know, killing Michigan roads, right? And this is part of it. Why Uber, I mean, you can make a...
And we got phone calls.
Yeah. 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 But is that what you were asking, a solution for roads or just, like, solution for life? Because that I don't have the answer for. But.
You know, we don't know that right now we're in the immediate aftermath of Proposal 1 and, you know, what was really a disastrous election for the proponents of road funding. So today they're saying we have to do something and we have to act quickly. We will see if that will is sustained in the coming weeks and months. To me, and this is subjective, this seems to me an awful lot like something that hangs out for the lame duck session.
So you're saying a year from this coming
yep.
December. Ouch. Oh, that hurts. Well, on that happy note, folks, I think we're going to end it there. I'll be able to hang around a little bit. If you guys have questions, maybe we can get Joe or Ken to be willing to do that. I know Rick has to leave pretty quickly, but if you guys have any questions that maybe we didn't get to answer, I'd be happy to answer them. Or just grab yourself another drink. Thank you to Brewery Vivant. Or are you doing all the thank you? Oh, okay, Steve, thank you, everyone.
Well, we'll thank them multiple times. Thank
yeah,
you,
yeah.
Brewery Vivant.
Thank you to Ken Sikkema for adding amazing insight. Again, you can hear Ken every Thursday afternoon on All Things Considered with our host, Jen White, and Susan Demas. Who is the wife, as I've mentioned, I think, numerous times. I totally have a girl crush of Joe DeSantis. Joe DeSantis Demas, Democratic strategist, who also is on stateside on Michigan radio often. Rick Pluta and myself, Zoe Clark. So thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And just a reminder again. Our stateside live broadcast May 21st. You can go to michiganradio.org and register. Again, huge thank you to the folks here at Brewery Vivant. And Chris wants to say a quick word.
All right, so let me just say I love that you all are here. This was my dream. I'm Chris Spalding. My husband and I own this place. And... All right, so seriously, from the time we invented the idea of Brewery Vivant, like, I've been all about this. It's actually in one of our manager's performance plans to get issues and ale at our place this year. So it's nice to see a dream realized. He gets a bonus. And then one other thing... I have so many questions I didn't ask, but I would like to put a plug for B Corporation as a status that the state of Michigan should recognize, and any person involved in politics, I would love to talk to you about that, but we're a certified B Corporation. What that means, if you're not familiar, is we focus strongly on the triple bottom line. We look at not just our profit, but our impact on people and planet, and we're basically put to the test to make sure that we're doing what we say we're doing. There's only five of us in West Michigan, another one on the east side, but we'd love the state to recognize that businesses that do good should be recognized. We're not even asking for additional benefits. We're just asking for a legal structure that sees what we're doing. So future topic.
All right, thank you again. Thanks all for coming.